Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. It's a beautiful day outside, but we hope you have some time to sit still and not just be out and looking at the incredible countryside, but joining us for a program for a while. We'll be with you for an hour. I want to remind you that our goal is to basically bring you credible, valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices addresses how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-range ramifications of change or sometimes lack of change in our society. Action for Healthy Communities, which is a project of the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation, is the underwriting organization and lead organization to put on this program for you. And the Action for Healthy Communities group does a report called Vital Signs, comes out every 3 years. And actually can remind you that the next study for that report will be done in May and June of this year for next late year release. So if you happen to get a call from one of our surveyors about information, we would appreciate you participating in that survey. If you'd like to look at older surveys from previous years, the last one was done in December of 2013. You can find the entire report at actionslo.org. And you can download the entire report or look at it online. There is no charge for that. It's available to you. We have an interesting program today, and it's a broad topic. We as people age, we've discovered in society that the risk of suicide and the risk of looking at your life as somewhat isolated and not as robust as you want it to be seems to happen with older age. And this is a topic that is probably not talked about very much. And the other kind of subcategory for that that we want to talk about is the fact that the LGBT community tends to have a higher rate of suicide for the elderly at the present time than the general population. And we want to look at some of the issues and ramifications about that. But it's a broad topic. It affects all of us, and we don't need to necessarily subclassify people to realize that it affects people. But a lot of people, as they age, it becomes a factor. Megan Boaz Alvarez, who's the clinical director at Transitions Mental Health Association, is with me today, along with Tracy Mello, and she's the director of senior services with Wilshire Community Services. And this is really what we want to talk about today. I do want to remind you that it is a call-in program. KCBX is a community, not just a radio station, and it's a public community. And you can give us a call at 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. And I highly recommend that if you want to call in and be part of the discussion, you do it reasonably early in the program. We've sometimes had people who want to talk to us in the last 5 or 6 minutes of the program, and we just pretty much run out of time before we really get to address their concerns. So I would recommend that you do that. It's interesting, the number of people that that when the issue of suicide comes up or there's been a suicide in their family or circle of friends often says that they've missed warning signs, that they weren't paying attention to something, that, gee, if they'd only thought about it and known about it, they would take a look at it, things a little differently. And that may be a big factor we need to talk about with our guest today. So I'll start. You know, Tracy, I guess we can start with you and tell me what senior services at Wilshire Community. Well, people mostly know what Wilshire Community Services is, but it wears a lot of hats.
Yes,
and
it does.
The aspect of senior services there and how you're working with and looking at the issue of suicide.
Sure, definitely. So I will talk briefly about all the programs that we offer at Wilshire Community Services, specifically for older adults. And then if you want me to go into any more depth about them, feel free to ask. So basically, we offer a continuum of services for older adults. We try to help people who are just beginning to struggle with issues associated with aging all the way to people who are having really serious issues associated with aging. So those programs include the Good Neighbor Program, which is a volunteer program that assists older adults in our community with things like housework, transportation, yard work, grocery shopping, minor home repairs. I think I named them all. There's also a program called the Caring Callers Program. That is a volunteer-based program that sends people out to the home of older adults who are primarily isolated. And isolation is one of the key risk factors with older adults. It can really lead to a number of issues, as well as the inability to adapt or adjust to some of the changes that we face while we age. So a lot of our programs address that issue of isolation. Caring Callers directly targets that. That is a volunteer program where somebody goes out to the home of an older adult and spends about an hour with them. And what's great about this program is when we reach a certain age, a lot of times the questions we get asked are, when's the last time you ate? Have you taken your medication? When are you going to the doctor? And this volunteer gets to come in and say, what do you want to do for fun? Tell me about your life. Tell me about your experiences. They teach each other things. We've had volunteers who have learned to knit from our clients. We've had clients who have learned to cook from our volunteers. So it really is a program where they can reciprocate and teach each other things, which is very unique about that individual program. We also have our senior peer counseling program. That is a program where volunteers go out to the home and provide one-on-one counseling for a variety of issues. It could be very general issues associated with aging and some of the struggles, to more specific issues like moving in with an adult child and the unique things that that relationship presents. These are volunteers. They're not necessarily trained clinical professionals. They are people who have a passion to help others in our community, particularly people who are aging in our community. And they go through a very intensive 72-hour training, and they receive clinical supervision from a clinician. So they get a lot of support, but they really are people who have a caring place in their heart and want to make a difference. And they are an amazing group of volunteers. We also have, so our two professional programs are our clearings program. So these are for clients who we assess to be a little outside the scope of what a volunteer is really trained to handle. A professional clinician will go out to the home and provide some direct targeted therapy sessions and hopefully get that person to a place where they can then benefit from less intensive services. And the newest member to our Wilshire family is our Older Adult Full Service Partnership Program. And that takes our continuum all the way up to older adults who are facing struggles associated with a serious mental illness. So schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression. We are able to provide some intensive case management and therapeutic supports to those individuals now as well.
It's a lot of programs.
It okay. is, yes.
need a bigger outline, and you may need a bigger website. We'll get into a little more details in about my question, but Megan, let me go to you and give us some understanding of what services you provide and what your involvement is with this through Transitions Mental Health.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. So Transitions Mental Health is dedicated to hope, recovery, and wellness, and also decreasing stigma associated with what people believe about mental health disorders. And we have treatment programs, we have housing programs, we have employment programs. Transitions really believes that being integrated back into the community is key in recovery and wellness. So whether it's through employment or volunteer, it's not just treatment. It's really integrating back into your community in some kind of meaningful way. We also have our SLO hotline, which is a 24-hour crisis line that's available to anybody in the community for support. And that's staffed by paid employees and also by wonderful volunteers. Always opportunities to do that if people are interested. And similar to the program that Wilshire has, we also have a full-service partnership program that offers a full array of mental health services to adults age up to 59 who have mental health disorders. So we provide treatment as well. And I think that's kind of a snapshot
yeah,
of
it's a good, good
the services
snapshot.
Of Transitions.
You know, as we talk about this, and I led in by doing what I hope was to dispelling one of the myths that we talk about and misconceptions by the knowledge I had, which is very limited, of course. But there seemed when I was looking at some of the comments that the two of you sent to us to put together an outline for the program, it was that a tremendous number of people don't think older adults commit suicide, that it's mm-hmm. only a young person's problem. It's people when there's desperation in their financial life or in their social life as young people, because we do hear a lot about suicide, unfortunately, with high school and college age members of our community, and those tend to be more visible. But there is this misconception that older people don't feel a desperation in that regard. I mean, I could use the premise, which I will say I don't necessarily subscribe to, but what comes to mind is, oh, gee, I'm 75 years old. I figured out how to get this far along. I'm not going to feel that desperate in the isolation or frustration of my life. And that's probably not the case. Which one of you wants to jump in on that first?
I'll make a couple comments. You're definitely right. It's not the case. And Okay. It's. I think there's a couple of myths or misconceptions that feed into that. The first one being that depression is a normal part of aging. When I first started working with the older adult population, I would tell people that I primarily was working with people who had depression. They would say, well, yeah, I mean, they're depressed. They're getting older. Isn't that just normal? And it's absolutely not. There are lots of people who give us examples of aging happy, healthy, and well. And so it is not, I think a lot of times when older adults present to their family members or their physicians even with some signs of depression, it's dismissed as normal. And so that's the first misconception that really leads to high amounts of suicides in older adults. The second thing is just like you said, people often think, well, they're depressed, but they're not going to take it to that level. And that's absolutely not true. The statistics show that older adult males in particular have the highest rate of suicide in our culture. So it definitely is something that needs to be addressed and needs to be taken seriously.
Is there any studies or specific information that talks about what the triggers are? I mean, it's getting from the point of, oh, I'm not happy with my life to, oh, I want to end it yesterday is a pretty drastic difference. And I'm wondering what you see as triggers in what puts people, for lack of a better way of putting it, this is obviously not a clinical term, over the edge.
Right. Well, it's not any one thing, of course. And it's really, I think it's similar across the age spans. We all have a limited ability to cope with stressors. And when it gets to be too much, I think that's when suicide starts to look like an option. I think when you're thinking about an older adult population specifically, some of the risk factors might be isolation, as Tracy mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Healthcare issues, having significant health problems is a risk factor for any age group for suicide. And so you start to get kind of these compound factors. Maybe there's a loss of a significant relationship or a partnership or a loss of a spouse. And then there may be financial problems in addition to that because now income has changed and you have some feelings of isolation. Add a health problem to that and you have more stressors than maybe somebody is able to cope with the resources that they have. And I think that's when suicide starts to look like an option. Yeah. It starts to sound better than struggling through what the person's going through.
Yeah, the concept of it sounding better is a kind of a strange concept. But yeah,
I would also add that with older adults in particular, there is a loss of integrity that plays into it. So when they start to lose some of their ability to live independently, especially the major things like losing the ability to drive, that is a huge factor. When an older adult loses the ability to drive, they can not only increase their isolation, but they start to lose some of that feeling of independence. When they start to need care with things like bathing, that becomes such a personal thing, and to start feeling like you're losing that ability to manage your own care and your own needs and to have strangers coming in doing things, it can feel like a loss of power. And when you start to feel that loss of power, you start to wonder, am I just going to continue to decline? What is next for me? Is there anything that's coming up that's going to be brighter for me? And when people in your life are not addressing that, when they're ignoring it because they think, or not choosing to ignore it, but they're excusing it as part of aging, then you don't necessarily feel the support that you need to see, yes, there is still a way that my life can be enriched and that I can continue to age in a way that is happy and healthy. You start to lose that feeling of hope when it's not addressed appropriately.
Yeah. I want to remind folks that we're talking about aging and issues with aging and issues of suicide in the aging population of our communities and how we are or are not paying attention to that. You're welcome to give us a call and be part of the discussion. The phone number is 781-3875. If you happen to be listening on the World Wide Web and you do not have a local phone, if you will, the area code is 805 and the phone number is 781-3875. We would love to have you part of the discussion if you'd like to join us today. This may be a touchy one. Let's just get it out of the way early because it's come up in a couple letters to the editor in some local newspapers. There are people, the state of California recently, in a bill that was introduced actually by the state senator for our area, allows for medical professionals to be involved in assisted suicide, for lack of a better word, for someone who is already terminally ill. There's been a lot of discussion in the media about, from people saying, this is just going to promote a feeling that suicide is okay for everybody, as opposed to deal with situations when suicide indeed may be a viable choice. It may not be something we want to talk about, but has that been a topic that's come up in your discussion with your peers and your clients?
You know, it's interesting that you brought that up. I was at our local suicide prevention forum recently, and that was a topic that came up. And looking at, is that something that our group wants to talk about or maybe have some discussion around? You know, and this is just my personal view. I see that kind of differently. When I think about somebody who's suicidal, I think about somebody whose set of life circumstances has brought them to a point where they're so overwhelmed, they're starting to think about that as an option. And every time, and I have lots of experience working with individuals who are suicidal in the middle of a suicide attempt, who are contemplating suicide therapeutically, working with them. And I feel like there is always hope in those situations. There's always some part of the person that's ambivalent. There's some part of them that still wants to live. They're still connected to something, their family, a neighbor. Sometimes it's a pet. Mm-hmm. And there's something that keeps them anchored here. And that gives you something to work with. It gives them something to hold on to and kind of room to work with them and intervene. Maybe there's a way that you could still live and live a life that you find some meaning in. When you're talking about medical issues that are so overwhelming and complex and so involved in terms of the pain that the person's going through and quality of life, I see that as kind of separate. For me, it's not quite the same issue. When you're talking about assisted suicide, I don't think you're talking about the same population that I have kind of in my frame of mind when I'm working with somebody who's suicidal.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me. I was actually surprised to see some of the comments in the media about it, because it seemed to imply that people would just – that the society would just see people as discardable if that was an option to them. And I read some statistics. I'm not quite – don't recall the exact statistics at the moment, but off the top of my head, Oregon, which has had this provision in their law for, I think, 4 or 5 years now at least, is seeing in the entire state seeing less than, I think, 50 or 60 people who have taken this as the option they wanted with medical professional involved in the discussion since the program went into play, which means there's not been this run on people believing suicide was necessarily a viable alternative because of the law, which for me was encouraging as a layman in the discussion. But I was surprised that it's a lot of people who are very concerned about it. The word for both of you, the word in the discussion that has come up, if we went back and played a tape of this, which we could do, but we won't anyway, the word isolation has probably come up more often than any single thing. It's in the notes of information you provide for us before the program. It's come up from both of you. A lot of the programs that you talk about that Wilshire Community Services has, my hunch is for a lot of people, they tell you they need help bathing, or they tell you they need help doing their laundry. And oftentimes that's it's a smokescreen for the fact what they really need is somebody to talk to.
Yes, very true.
And that becomes a big factor for them. So what avenues are there available? If you have an older person who doesn't need a lot of assistance, they're still reasonably agile and mobile, but for whatever reason, it may be because at their age, a lot of their friends and family members are no longer alive. How does the individual involved work to conquer their own loneliness, I guess, is a lack of a better way to put it?
That's a great question. I think a lot our society doesn't necessarily view social engagement as a necessity to life. It is that you tend to think of those things of food, clothing, and shelter, but definitely that social engagement, feeling part of your community, is such a critical piece to aging well in our society. And so we have excellent case managers. Whenever somebody is referred to any of our programs, we do a home face-to-face visit with that individual. And so that really gives us the chance to see, do they really need help with grocery shopping, or is it that they're isolated and they're really needing someone to speak to talk to? And then we can help to connect them to resources in our community. If they are still able to independently get out, if they're still driving or they're able to use our public transportation, there are definitely resources in the community they can access. We have an active senior center here. We have activities that they can join in on. If that is a difficulty for them, then definitely caring callers becomes an option, or even senior peer counseling to look at what issues are affecting your willingness or your ability to get out and engage with individuals, and then helping to tear away at that and figuring out a way to encourage them and to support them as they venture into this new arena of their life. A lot of them have had either a spouse or a partner who they've spent a majority of their life with, so they haven't had the opportunity or maybe the motivation to seek out new relationships. So it's a very different, how do you meet people at this age? How do you start a conversation? What do you talk about? And so helping them to get comfortable with this new role they're playing and helping them to really have the courage to build new relationships and meet new people.
Do you work with people who maybe things as simple as you're able to do it, but you haven't done it? Get on the local bus, take the bus to the local library, and instead of reading sitting in your own living room by yourself, read sitting in a reading room at a public library. I don't know if things as simple as that. What kind of response do you get from seniors when you suggest things like that? They might throw a book at you, I realize.
It's very varied. I'd say a lot of times we hear, I don't want to be around a bunch of old people when we when we suggest things like the senior center. And so it is really...
I hate bridge.
I don't want to play bingo. It really is trying to find that individual niche and helping them, looking at... What were you interested in when you were 30? Is there a way that you can still get that same joy or that same fulfillment you got from that activity in a different way? And it's also, it's important to also point out that I had a client who was close to her 90s, and she said, look, I've been active my whole life. If I want to sit here and watch TV, what is wrong with that? So we also really have to look at, is it a problem for that person? If they are content being alone most of the day and reading quietly or watching television, then maybe that is okay for them. It really is really are those people who are saying, I'm alone and it's a problem for me. I feel lonely, or we're noticing that they're not eating as much because they don't have somebody to eat with, or they're not getting out as much because they feel unsafe going out alone. It's really looking at those pieces and figuring out who needs our assistance engaging in social activity and who maybe really does just want to sit and read quietly.
An incident that in my own life from a number of years ago, my mother moved here from Los Angeles, and this is now almost 20 years ago when this happened. My mother moved here from Los Angeles. I found her a great apartment in downtown San Luis Obispo. I lived in Grover Beach at the time. Mm-hmm. Great apartment in downtown San Luis Obispo. And I said, this is great. You can walk to the market. You can walk to the senior center. You can walk to the bus. And she says, but I can't walk or drive to your house. It's too far away. I said, yeah, but I can get to you anytime you want. She ended up – and we found her a couple of apartments downtown. She ended up in an apartment very nearby where I lived at the time in Grover Beach. But it didn't occur to her that between my immediate family other than her and my job, the ability to see her on a daily basis wasn't as available. But she chose to not live near where things were that she could easily walk to. And that became actually a struggle in our family about that discussion. She never moved out of that apartment building. And frankly, to walk across that apartment building was a longer walk than to walk from her a possible apartment in downtown San Luis Obispo to the supermarket. But she seemed to think that was okay. How do you address those kind of things with seniors?
It's a difficult conversation. I have a grandmother who is 98, and this your discussion.
We should
of your
all
mom,
be so lucky, wow!
Right? I know. I think that all the time. She's my role model for aging, certainly. Okay. But she's starting to lose some independence. But she also, we really have to pay attention to what she wants, because she's very clear on what she wants. Mm-hmm. She stays with my aunt once in a while when she's sick. She does not want to stay with a family member. She wants to be independent. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want family members to have to pick her up and ferry her places. Her independence is probably the most important thing to her, and that might be different for somebody who wants to be – I mean, she's close to family. We see her regularly, but she does not want to be dependent on somebody else or She'll describe it as being a burden. We don't feel that way, but she does. And I think you have to listen to that. I think you have to take into consideration. I think Tracy mentioned maybe somebody's okay sitting by themselves a lot of the time, enjoys being by themselves. And you want to take individual differences into account. If it seems problematic, then you want to try to get people to try some new things.
Do we find a lot of seniors that, I guess, if they can find peers to talk to, they'll talk to peers. But you mentioned earlier that they don't want to. People don't want to go to the senior center because they don't want to be around old people, right. Even though the reality is they're around people their same age as them. So how do we overcome the, okay, let's see, I'm 80 years old and I would really rather be around 50-year-old people, but there aren't any 50-year-old people who want to be around me and I don't want to be at the senior center. And that becomes an interesting tug of war. Mm-hmm. But I think for isolation, that's probably a big factor.
Yes, yeah. And it's probably a big battle, but it really is battling that stigma of it's okay to age. It can be beautiful to age. You know, we had a volunteer who in her 80s went on an African safari. So it's not saying that you have to go as far as going on an African safari, but it is recognizing that you don't have to define your limits by your chronological age. You can still experience the joys of life throughout the life cycle. So I think that is an important thing for people to realize. Even people who are in their 80s need to still fight that stigma that it is okay to age. And we usually just ask clients, try it one time. Go to the senior center one time. If you don't like it, you never have to go back. Or go to this activity one time. And usually if you can get them out there, what they have built in their mind is not the reality, and they're able to see that and they have a great time. Our senior center does exercise classes, Tai Chi. They have lunches there. So there's a lot of enjoyable activities. And once they experience that and realize it's not this horrible thing they had imagined in their mind, then they're more likely to go back and to really get fulfillment from it.
Okay. Let me remind you folks that this is a program we'd like you to be part of the discussion of if you want to be part of the discussion. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. Both questions, observations, concerns, or tell us about something we're not paying attention to in the program at the moment that we should be paying attention to. So you're welcome to call in and we can talk about that. I'd briefly hit on the fact that one of the key populations that may feel somewhat more isolated in some cases is the gay and lesbian community. Gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender. I want to be real clear about that. And I was speaking with someone I know who is a lesbian and is older than I am. And by the way, I'm 65. And she basically said that we may think of that population, on what's happened in the last 10 years, as not being as isolated as it used to. But she reminded me that's great for young people. That's great for people maybe under 50 in that community. But people over 70 grew up in a very isolated world, and they grew up without too many of their peers that really understood who they were. Mm-hmm. A lot of what their lifestyle was very secret. And I had not thought of it that way. I grew up in a family that we had, you know, gay and lesbian members of our community and of our family, and it was something we were very aware of and didn't think of it as a negative, even though be real clear, the person who provided – a couple who provided daycare for me when my mom worked a couple of days of work – week were a lesbian couple, and all I knew them as Connie and Pat, who lived around the corner, and nothing else from that standpoint. But they would they would be in their late 80s now if they are still alive. I don't know, but that community has had a tough time over the last few decades, even though the last few years we're seeing a lot of openness. Mm-hmm. How does that affect the issue of isolation and desperation for those members of the community?
You know, I definitely think that that's a factor. When you talk about that generation, there was not the same openness or people being comfortable coming out of the closet. And I've read recently that some older adults actually find themselves going back into the closet in the settings that they're in because there is not the same acceptance or tolerance or ability to disclose that to people. People even avoid going to see their primary care doctor or for medical issues because of fear of judgment or discrimination or stigma. So I think that that is a reality for that older adult population. We see a lot of progress with our younger populations. We see campus events on our college campuses that support people being open about who they are. And I don't think our older adults have that same opportunity in their church or social setting or maybe even with their families.
So it's a factor we need to look at, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I want to not keep – we've got, Susan in San Luis Obispo. Susan, are you there?
Yes, I'm still here.
You're on the air. Thank you for your patience. Glad you called in.
Oh, no problem. One of the things that – I'm a senior citizen, and one of the things that I find is great therapy for me is to get – to a coffee shop, and I have gotten into conversations with people of all ages, really young children and on up in, you know, way past my age, and a lot of college students are always open and willing to talk about their travels and their studies, and I just find that just a real refreshing way of, you don't have to be around, you know, like going to the senior center, you don't have to be around just seniors. You open up your population a lot more, and then when, instead of like going to the library where you're expected to be somewhat quiet, at a coffee shop, people go there and they can have their book or their telephone to kind of go back to if they get nervous, but they're right there and they present themselves, and if they kind of join in, most people seem very willing to talk.
Susan, let me ask, this is Fred, I'm going to ask you a question. Did you move or change your living environment that gave you more opportunity to do that, or were you just, you had the benefit of living near those kinds of services and communities before you aged?
Well, part of it is I'm very centrally located, and even though, you know, I can still drive, and I drive at times, but I could also walk to the coffee shop. So I'm very well located, close to grocery stores and close to downtown and close to a couple of great coffee shops. So I just feel very fortunate to be able to do that still. And it brings great joy to my life.
Well, thank you very much for the call, and that brings up a very good point, and I'm glad you've helped validate what we've talked about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for listening.
Take care.
Fred.
Okay.
Bye.
Yeah, it's people, if they just get out the door, I guess, in a lot of cases, it makes a difference. Both of your organizations are working mostly with, well, you're working with people who, frankly, are still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any studies done or any material that you look at with people who have ended their life in some by choice or desperation standpoint as to what the contributing factors are? Because they may be different in Santa Barbara than they are in Santa Maria. They may be different in Paso Robles than they are in San Luis Obispo. And, of course, they may be different in a different state. But I'm wondering if you look at, what is missing in our community? Simple things like, we've discovered that most of the people who have who've come up and we've seen that have committed suicide recently feel isolated and don't live near public transportation as much as we'd like to see. What kind of, for lack of a better, it's a post-mortem on someone's death, but...
Right. There is actually an entire process called the psychological autopsy, where we back and look at the factors that seem like maybe contributed to the circumstances of a death by suicide. And really, you know, a lot of the research in suicidology points to a couple of things being key. One is a sense of isolation. And so our caller, Susan, who talked about being able to connect with people being so key in her day-to-day life, that's huge. It's part of the human condition. If we don't feel connected to other people, we don't do well just as human beings, whether we're an older adult or somebody with mental illness. Not being connected is really key. And then a sense of being a burden is another key factor. And then loss of hope. I mean, if there are three big ones that are common factors, it's probably those three. And then, of course, there are individual circumstances that contribute to those different factors, but isolation, that lack of connection to other people, feeling like you're a burden, those are really key in a death by suicide.
Okay. We've talked a lot kind of like what the older population needs to look at in their own lives. If you're dealing with an older family member or friend who says, oh, life is fine and everything's grand and leave me alone, I'm wondering what as a family member or as a friend of that person you do to kind of break down that form of denial, if you will, because my hunch is the person who is contemplating suicide is probably very good at telling an awful lot of people the day before they do it that everything was fine, and leave me alone. And I'm wondering how you break that cycle.
Well, I think being present is really key, being willing to ask questions. In my both personal life and professional life, if I have thought that maybe somebody was at risk of suicide, I ask. And it's, you know, it's kind of an awkward question, quite frankly, especially if it's in a social setting. But paying attention to changes, noticing that maybe the person isn't engaging in things the way they used to, and being willing to take that time and find out what that's about. Maybe they are okay being by themselves, but if it's a change, that's something to pay attention to. When people stop engaging in church or social things or family things that they were connected to before, that's something to pay attention to and to explore. And trying to get people re-engaged in things. I love what Tracy said about getting somebody to come just one time to whatever it is, whether it's one of the senior centers or the library or bingo night, although my grandmother as an older person is like, I hate bingo. I'm not playing bingo. There's nothing to do here besides bingo. So again, taking in mind individual differences and preferences, the wellness centers that transitions have are a great place. There are people from all different age groups who are there for support groups or a social group or an outing or a movie or a cooking class or a crochet class. But getting people reconnected, I think, is really the task that needs to be done, just engagement.
Yeah. As many people may know, if they followed it in the media, this is a factor in San Luis County that recently there was a large dispute about whether or not there would be a behavioral health facility in Templeton. It was passed unanimously by the Planning Commission. It was passed unanimously by the Board of Supervisors. We haven't had a facility within easy drive for San Luis Obispo, or really for easy drive from Santa Barbara, if you're down in Santa Barbara, because the nearest facility we understand was in Ventura, which made it. And one of the things I was at the public hearing at the Planning Commission about that topic was that the feeling that there were not places nearby where one could get inpatient services, the county mental health facility for the county can handle up to, I think, 12 or 16 people at a time. But people there from that facility were speaking about the fact that that will never be enough. Whether or not that facility is – obviously it's not built yet, but whether or not both of your organizations see that kind of resource in the community as a factor.
I would definitely say that it definitely is a factor. You have people who are getting services from the ER because they really don't have another option. You have people who are having to leave their loved ones and going to very remote areas, like you said, to Ventura or Bakersfield to receive the services that they need because there's nothing local. So again, increasing their isolation and taking them away from some of their support system. You have people who go without services because they don't have access to it and they're not sure how to access it. And so increasing the visibility of services, increasing access to services, I think is always a positive thing.
The San Luis County and Santa Barbara County both have basically a gay and lesbian alliance, and I'm not sure about Santa Barbara County. I wish I'd known that. Look at that before the program, but I'm aware in San Luis County there is a senior arm of the Gay and Lesbian Alliance, and it looks like the population at the senior center, and I'm wondering whether or not that arm of the gay and lesbian community is doing anything specifically or working with either of your organizations to address a better awareness within their own community.
Definitely. I actually just met with Tarya prior to coming to the show.
Okay.
So she is the director there. There's a senior advocate there at Gala, and they are very active, and they have a lot of different things that they do to outreach to the community, as well as bringing them into the center and having activities. So they are very involved in our community for sure.
Okay. And it's a population that I guess has become more visible. There's been a couple of gay pride events in Mission Plaza in San Luis Obispo, and some down in Santa Barbara, where there actually is a group of seniors within that community that have been very visible. And I think in some cases, someone the woman I know from South County, who is a lesbian and older than I am, actually said that she ran into people who've known her for years who just kind of said, "Oh, I didn't know you were a lesbian." And mm-hmm. It's like, okay. Her thought was, and why was it important that you know that? But I guess for a lot of people, that segmenting of society is going away, but for an awful long time it was very pronounced.
And that's a great point, especially for service providers. Oftentimes when I'm talking to service providers, they say, well, we don't really have a large LGBT community in our area, so we don't really have to worry about that. And if they're saying that, they're probably not asking the right questions. They're not asking the questions in the right way, because especially for the aging population, it's difficult to disclose that, especially to a stranger who's coming into your home to provide a service. So reframing the way that you ask some questions, for example, instead of saying, are you married, asking, do you have a partner or are you in a relationship, leaving those questions very open, and so it's not so specific for them. They can feel more comfortable to disclose information. And as a service provider, it is very important to know those things, because we were working with a client who was grieving the loss of someone that she identified as a friend or as a roommate. Come to find out, they were actually in a romantic relationship, but she was fearful of disclosing that. So the bereavement services that you provide to somebody may look different if you think that they're grieving the loss of a friend versus the loss of a partner, the loss of a spouse. And so it is very important that those things are paid attention to and addressed, so that the people are getting the right services and the level of service they really need to deal with what they're dealing with.
Is there, for either of you, is there a way to broach that question in a way that's not intrusive for a lot of your clients? Because it obviously is a question that having the answer to would help you provide more services. But we don't walk up to people and say, hi, nice to meet you. Are you gay or are you straight? I don't know how we address that.
Well, I think we do have a little bit of an advantage as service providers, because we ask a lot of nosy questions.
Okay, right.
So I think we can get away with that one. But I love what Tracy said about how you frame it. You don't say, are you married?
Yeah.
You say, do you have a partner?
Yeah.
You open that up so that it's more inclusive. You ask the question in a way that it's inclusive of people who are not in a heterosexual marriage. You need to ask about more than just that.
Yeah. What are the issues that perpetuate the isolation for that community? Are there some specific issues that are different than what perpetuates the isolation for the broader community?
Statistically, there are some differences. People are more likely to not have a partner, so to be on their own. They're less likely to have children, which puts them in a position of maybe not having the family supports that their heterosexual counterparts might have. So there are definitely some differences when you look at the family situation, the partnering situation. Income tends to be lower, and I'm not sure if that's a result of not mm-hmm. having been in a relationship with two incomes at some point. Mm-hmm. But those things are definitely factors when you look at the statistics, and I think they contribute to that isolation or disconnection from the rest of the community.
Yeah. Let me remind you folks that we're talking about issues of suicide and aging, and if you want to be part of this discussion, we have a few more minutes to take some calls if you'd like. The phone number is 781-3875. Give us a call if you'd like, and if you're just enjoying the discussion and finding it enlightening by itself, we understand that. Occasionally, I've talked to people who were occasional callers, and I've seen them in other settings, and I'll say, gee, we haven't heard from you in a while. They said, well, yeah, the topic was really interesting, so I decided that I couldn't contribute anything, but sometimes the questions we get from the public are give us an understanding of what we may have missed or not paid attention to.
Mm-hmm.
So if you'd like to be part of the discussion, 781-3875. We have a couple of more minutes we can take calls for. The entire population without any confinement about lifestyle, history, whatever. Are there particular clues that that friends and family can really specifically pay attention to that give you some idea of what you can do to step in, what you can do to start some kind of intervention with a friend or family member that's not doing well?
There are a lot of things to look for, and there are some good resources online if people want to look at what the different warning signs of suicide look like. Mm-hmm. Suicideispreventable.org is a great one and lists some of the basic really warning signs to look for. Kind of customized, looks at youth and older adult and general mm-hmm. population, but that disengagement from things that people are typically involved in, whether it's a teenager who stops playing sports or an older friend who stops going to church who you haven't seen in a while, withdraw from the things that they used to enjoy, that's a big red flag. That's something to pay attention to. Hey, I haven't seen you at Bunko or church or mm-hmm. volleyball, whatever it is. Are you doing okay? And I think stopping to ask that question, are you okay?
Yeah, that's a good, simple question, which leaves mm-hmm. it open. And if you get the quick, simple, oh yeah, everything's fine answer, you probably know to ask a few
Keep
more
asking.
Questions. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. If everything's fine, okay, it becomes easier to understand. Let's see. Is it a dare? Is that correct? Are you there? Hello?
I'm
you're,
here.
You're okay. Yeah. Is your first name Adair? I'm sorry.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Adair, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm thank you for taking my call. I kind of wanted to weigh in on the LGBT senior aspect of it. I've worked with Taria and the Gala Center on knowing of her senior advocacy for it, and then I just wanted to point out a couple of parts that they do offer. One area that I found that was a need and still is a need when senior advocacy works with other senior centers is the fact that a lot of the LGBT seniors, either they have been closeted again, like you mentioned, or oftentimes in the past, a lot of their partners were not accepted by outside family members. And so they were not put into maybe the same room if it was an assisted living situation. Mm-hmm. The partners could not be together. So that was a big factor that I think hasn't been broached yet. That would further the isolation, or they would be embarrassed to say that, maybe out of fear of how they would be treated or fear of being mistreated if their LGBT status is known.
That's a yeah. great point.
Thanks for the point. Appreciate the call.
Thank you so much.
Okay. I believe I'm not sure if it changed in California based upon the legalization of gay marriage, but the ability for older adults to be a designated legal partner, mm-hmm. I think a lot of the push for that many years ago when it first happened was based upon the ability to be involved in the medical decisions and things like that. So mm-hmm. has the legalization of gay marriage affected any of those in the work that you've either do?
You know, honestly, I can't say for sure, but I would say that it extends beyond partners. A lot of times, because of the discrimination, the stigma that our older adult LGBT population faced, a lot of them broke ties to their biological family, and they created what's called a chosen family. And so it extends to people they identified as brothers, sisters, cousins, not being allowed to visit them or not being included in their health care because they weren't biological family. And I don't know, I can't say for sure if the marriage law changed that. Do you? Megan, do you have anything?
Well, in the settings that I've worked in, we've always honored an individual's request to have a specific person involved in their care, whether it was a mm-hmm. friend, a sibling, family member, domestic partner. So whether I was working for County Mental Health or now working for Transitions, we support an individual's right to involve anybody in their care that they choose. I think some of the pieces that may have changed would be more in a medical setting where the primary patient can no longer say, hey, I want my partner to come in and be part of this, and family may have excluded them. But I think employers recognize domestic partnerships, and so that gets people looped into insurance and consent and involved legally. And then I think the change in the marriage laws makes a difference as well now.
Yeah. It's good to hear. We have one other call. Let's see. Summer, are you there?
Summer, I am.
Okay, you're part of the discussion. Please jump in.
Okay. I just wanted to bring up the point and have you address this, if you will, please. The fact that Medicare and or Medi-Cal does not pay for dentures for the elderly and glasses and hearing aids, which is, I think, kind of important for if you want to drive or eat. So I'm wondering if you could address that or have any comment about that.
I can say that I agree with you that it's a travesty that they don't pay for those things. We have a lot of clients who do suffer with not only swallowing issues because they can't chew their food appropriately, but it also affects your self-esteem and the way that you view yourself. And there are resources in town. The Knorr Clinic here in town has a dental side that has been very good to our clients who have been unable to get dentures, and they've been able to
glasses as well.
So there are, we have a great community here. There are some resources, but it's you are definitely right. It is something that I wish we could change.
Yeah. Well, that's great to know about the Knorr Clinic. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
And
that's a very good point. Thank you very much for the call.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Yeah, that hadn't occurred to me, and I'm very glad that Summer called in with that comment, because I guess if I don't have any teeth anymore, my ability to want to go out and sit in a social place and talk to new people is going to be very different or limited, or I'm just not going to go there.
Yeah.
Or imagine not being able to hear well enough to participate in a conversation. Again, I think of my grandma, who's 98, who has excellent hearing aids and still struggles with being in that setting. And I remember doing an exercise in graduate school where they had us smear our glasses with Vaseline, taped up our fingers, and put cotton in our ears so that we could experience what it might be like to try to conduct a conversation when you're having vision difficulties and hearing difficulties. And when you think about the isolation piece and getting engaged in a new social environment, how do you go into a new social environment when you have those barriers? I think that really is a challenge.
Yeah. Is there anything in our local Central Coast community that you're seeing that's different than what is seen as the national standard or the national dilemma, if you will, around this topic?
For suicide, a little bit. It's still our older adults in San Luis Obispo County that have the highest rate of death by suicide. Mm-hmm. Nationally, there's been a little bit of a shift, and it's more of a middle-aged male population. And we haven't seen that change in San Luis Obispo County, and I'm not entirely sure what that's about.
Is a lot of that based upon economic situations? We've talked with the media and politicians have talked about the decline of the middle class's ability to make a living, even though we're in an economic recovery. I wonder if that's affecting on a national standpoint, the desperation of the middle-aged people.
You know, you can't say that it's a cause and effect relationship, but I can tell you in kind of suicide prevention circles and in the research field, we definitely see a correlation between the economy tanking and the suicide rate for that middle-aged male population increasing. So, you know, we think that's connected. We can't say it's a causal relationship, but they certainly coincide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your work is fascinating, and I guess part of me says I'm sorry that you have to spend a lot of time dealing with the crises of potential suicide, but we're very lucky to have resources like both of your organizations in the community to address that. We've only got a few minutes left. I'll give you both a couple of minutes to make sure we cover what we maybe haven't covered or you want to make sure the listeners go away with. So, Megan, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get on my soapbox about suicide because
get on your soapbox.
You gave me the opportunity to, and I never pass one up. Again, truly, most people who are suicidal are not intent on dying. They just cannot manage anymore with the circumstances that they have. And if somebody's willing to listen and be present and say, hey, are you okay? It can absolutely change the outcome of what's happening with that person. Most suicidal people, if you look at statistics, will never have another suicidal crisis again. If they get through the current one, they will never have this happen again. And they'll be okay, and they'll move on, and they'll live their lives.
That's a fascinating bit of information. It never occurred to me. So people who've attempted suicide or thought about it seriously enough to either seek some help or have somebody get connected with them and have stayed alive are likely to never have that feeling again.
Most people will never have another suicidal crisis again. So if somebody, if a friend, and it's so much more often a friend or a family member, can just say, are you okay? And you're not okay. Okay, then let's get through this together. Let me help you. I don't know what to do, but I'll call somebody. I'll call a hotline and we'll find out what to do. We'll figure it out together. Just doing that can literally save somebody's life.
Wow.
Yeah, it's powerful. It's powerful,
that
right?
That is very powerful, and I'm glad I asked the question so you could share that with us. Thank you very much.
I am too.
Okay. Okay, Tracy, it's your turn.
Okay.
Give us some insights here. Okay. So we can. I want all of us to basically be able to walk out of here with a better understanding of what we can do to make a difference,
yeah.
Or what we can do to stop the cycle in our own life.
I would say never miss an opportunity to interact with an older adult, whether it's a grandparent, an aging aunt or uncle, or your siblings. Call them. Ask them how they're doing. I love my work. I feel like every day I am watching an amazing movie unfold or reading the best novel I've ever read in my life. The stories, the wisdom that come from older adults is something that is just magical. And don't miss an opportunity to interact with them, whether that's volunteering or, like I said, reaching out to a family member or someone in the community and just saying hi. I loved the caller, Susan, who talked about being in a coffee shop and interacting with people from all different age groups. And I really admire the courage that she has to do that. And I would encourage other people to take that opportunity to connect with your neighbor, connect with people in the community that you see, and just never miss an opportunity to get to know somebody. It could change your life. It could enrich your life.
It's interesting you'd say that, and something occurred to me because I had this discussion with my wife not too long ago, and that is that in some of the information, the rate of suicide for older men is a lot higher than it is for older women.
Mm-hmm.
I think we still live in a society that if a strange man starts to talk to you in a coffee house,
yes,
you're less likely to have a conversation with them. If a strange woman starts to talk to you in a coffee house, you're usually willing to start the conversation. And I think that may be a factor that we need to think about with regard to people in your own life or people you run into.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't specifically said this, but it occurred to me as I was listening to both of your comments. I guess what we can maybe suggest to our listeners is think of somebody in your life that you haven't talked to in a long time that seems somewhat isolated and pick one person like that. Maybe you pick one person a week and just give them a phone call for 5 or 10 minutes or whatever it is at the time. You might make a difference in someone's life, and
yes,
you might keep them around for a while longer than you didn't realize it mattered.
Yes, and we often think that we're too busy to do that, but if you don't take the opportunity today, you may not have it. So take that 5 minutes and make the phone call.
Okay.
For sure.
Thank you to both of you. This has been a wonderful program today, and I thank you for being part of this discussion. It's not a cheery topic, but it's an important topic we need to pay attention to in our community, and it becomes a big factor. I want to remind all of you that Central Coast Voices, as I said before, is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Chris Kington Barker will be your host next week. She and I alternate weeks, and she'll be speaking with Jefferson Eccles, the Executive Director of the Home Builders Association of the Central Coast, and Jerry Ryu, who's the Executive Director of the Housing Trust Fund of the Central Coast, and they're going to discuss the crisis in affordable housing on the Central Coast and how it impacts our community, because it's been a very big factor. Some things to think about is that the National Association of Home Builders and the Wells Fargo Housing Foundation in 2015 looked at the Opportunity Index with regard to affordable housing and discovered that San Luis Obispo County is the fourth least affordable housing market in the entire California region, and that is a big factor, that it is be very, very difficult to find housing for that population. We want you to be part of the discussion, and Chris will be here with those guests next week talking about housing issues. Central Coast Voices is sponsored, as I said before, by Action for Healthy Communities. This program is also underwritten by a generous grant from Joan Gellert Sargent, and we thank her for her support. You can contact us at voices@kcbx.org or 543-2323. Thank you to my guests today, Megan and Tracy. It's been a wonderful program. Thank you for listening and being part of the discussion. Remind you, we're here every week on Thursdays at 1 o'clock. Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week. And This American Life is up on Central Coast Public Radio KCBX next. Thanks for joining us.